Good afternoon. This is The LaRouche Show. It's March 22, 2003, and I am your host for today, Marcia Mary Baker. I am with the Economic Section of EIR News Service. Now, we begin, we have many guests today, and I'll introduce them in a minute, but we begin with a very deep recognition of the war in Iraq, many other historic developments this particular week, and I want to pass along a comment LaRouche made to his staff and friends around the world 3 days ago as the bombing began. He said, I am on the case, and he sure is. I want to say that where Mr. LaRouche is right now, this second, is in Germany. He's participating in a weekend-long international conference at the spa town of Bad Schwalbach, and he's meeting with leaders from India, China, Russia, Africa, many places throughout Europe, and also there's a youth movement delegation there from the United States, from North America, in fact, and youth leaders from throughout Europe. Now, let me just mention, before I introduce our guest, the title of the conference going on right now, March 22nd in Germany. It's called How to Reconstruct a Bankrupt World. And that hints at what we're going to be discussing on our own show today, whose theme is The United States is not an imperial power. What is the truth about U.S. imperialism? Now, I want to just say this in passing. Please look for the keynote to the European conference this weekend that LaRouche gave March 21st on the relevant websites. It's not there yet, but within 48 hours, I think it's a must-read for everyone. You know, those of you listening on shortwave or those of you on the telephone organizer's conference call, you know where to look, www.larouchepub.com. That's, of course, LaRouchePub.com. Or look on LaRouche's presidential campaign website, LaRoucheIn2004.com. That's 2004.com. Because I won't try and summarize what LaRouche said. One of our guests here did speak with him within the last hour. But let me just state the theme and introduce our guest now. What LaRouche was saying in Germany yesterday was that we face, when we look at it, we have a question, why has the U.S. degenerated so badly to get into this mess we're in today? What about the U.S. population? And what is required of us in the way of leadership to get out of this path of sure destruction? You could call it a classical tragedy unfolding, but as LaRouche reported last night, there are remedies. Now, come around to our guests by pointing out just one more thing here on the LaRouche Show you're listening to, that is that there's a very special piece of material circulating in over a million copies right now in the United States. I hope those of you listening are involved in this mass circulation. It's from a week ago. It's Lyndon LaRouche's summary report on the situation today, and it leads off with it has three pieces, but the lead-off one is called The Truth About U.S. Imperialism, and it also discusses how liberalism, economic, free trade, and all that kind of stuff is behind the fascism we're seeing that we confront today. So, and the point is Lyndon LaRouche said either it's going to be the solution today is going to be one or the other. It's not going to be a general run of options. Either Lyndon's FDR approach or Joe's Hitler, that is Joe Lieberman's Hitler, if you look at the U.S. political scene. So where did we start from as a nation many centuries ago? That's our topic, and our panel includes the following throughout the show. There are three scholars, David Chavin and Ed Spanas, who are based here at the Executive Intelligence Review National Center near Washington, D.C. We have on the phone Phil Valenti. He's in Philadelphia. All three of these people have published much material on the history from the 16, 17, 18, 1900s about the founding philosophy of our nation. And I also want to say we have a panel of youth leader scholars with us today. I'm going to introduce their names during halfway into the show, and they will be joining also the discussion after the internet, the LaRue Show, ends at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. They will be on the conference call, too, with Harley Schlanger, who is LaRouche's campaign representative. So that's a lot of introduction, but let's go right to the panel for them to state themselves some of the key points about the founding of our nation. Namely, here's a question. There are a lot of fairy tales about who were active in the founding of our country, and names are mentioned like Adam Smith and John Locke. Also, there are fairy tales about wonderful people like Ben Franklin, that he just came out of the blue. Let me just turn right to one of the three people I've introduced. Phil Valenti, how are you, and would you say something about the lineup of who founded our country?
Sure. No, I think this is it really is shows the power of ideas and history, and also to emphasize the point that Lyndon LaRouche made that you referred to, with this idea that somehow the United States is an imperialist power, and somehow the enemy of the world is the United States, and somehow American youth have to protest American imperialism and be hostile to their own country. And of course, we know there's been this fight in American history. There has been this imperialistic faction, which has a special history to it. But if you go right to the core of it, we have to root out the axiom from which all this is derived, which is definitely this complete lie about the role of John Locke in the writing of the Declaration of Independence and the founding of the country, the basic concepts of the United States. And you find this lie every place. I know here in Philadelphia, you go to the Graff House, which was it's a reconstructed house where Jefferson drafted the Declaration. And of course, there was a committee set up, including Franklin, Adams, and others to rewrite it. But of course, if you walk in the building and there are influences on the Declaration, there's John Locke. Number one. You read Bertrand Russell's Fractured History of Philosophy, major effort to portray John Locke as a inspiration for the Declaration of Independence. So if it's true that the United States Revolution was actually inspired by British philosophy, what kind of revolution is that? Didn't we fight the revolution against the British? Or was it just a temporary dispute over secondary issues involving taxes and afterwards we let bygones be bygones and we're really the same? Or was there really a fundamental axiomatic life and death division between the two? So this is where the Locke issue becomes so crucial. So Locke, I mean, there should be no question, Russell's fraud is typical. Bertrand Russell says, well, the fact that the Declaration uses the term self-evident is sure evidence of Locke's influence. Because that comes, I mean, as if the word self-evident or that expression is unique to Locke. But you notice that he ignores what comes after on the question of the inalienable rights, which we've written about a lot. But that should be, and of course, this gets to the question of the American people and how gullible, how, let's say, slaves to authority students tend to be, that they would go into a classroom and actually accept such a line when the evidence is glaring out at them with neon signs virtually on the question of the pursuit of happiness versus property. And we've written a lot about this, that if you look at John Locke's treatise on civil government, I mean, it's ad nauseum that the purpose and sole purpose of government is to preserve lives, liberties, and estates, which I call by the general name property, and on about property. Which is, isn't that different than the pursuit of happiness? I know that David found an interesting quote from some Bob's Merrill series, David, and right, used by universities, where they actually attempt to say, well, they really mean the same thing. So this should be a glaring piece of evidence that there's a fundamental difference. And just in terms of Locke, let me just say that everything the American Revolution was fought against and all the indictments of King George in the Declaration, most of those were to the direct responsibility of Locke in terms of oppression, exploitation of the American colonies. And just a couple of points on that. When Lyndon LaRouche talks about the issue of central banking, certainly one of the granddaddies of the Federal Reserve and the so-called central bank, which is independent of the government of the people, is the Bank of England, which was founded in 1694, which was 6 years after the so-called Glorious Revolution, when the Dutch William of Orange and his bride Mary came over from Holland to take the British throne. So you get the Anglo-Dutch connection. And, of course, one of the founding investors was John Locke himself in the Bank of England, which was all private subscribers, a certain elite group, really an oligarchy being established. And the government was then, the role of the government was simply to be in debt, permanently in debt, and subjugated to this private bank called the Bank of England. It's interesting that a couple of years later, some of the people who were Gottfried Leibniz's friends in England tried to form a rival to the Bank of England called the Land Bank. And that bank was sabotaged with the help of Isaac Newton. That Newton was sort of a version of Alan Greenspan of his day, or Paul Volcker. He was the master of the mint. The last 30 years of his life, he worked for the Bank of England and that group as the master of the British mint, coining the money. And he arranged a shrinking of the money supply so that that land bank would fail. 1696, the Board of Trade established, which was designed to have maximum exploitation of the colonies, prohibiting any manufacturing in the colonies. Locke was a founding member of the Board of Trade. You have Locke's drafting of the Poor Laws soon after that, which specified that he was very concerned, as we used to hear Newt Gingrich being concerned, or the neoconservatives today, about the children of laboring people are maintained in idleness, so their labor is lost to the public until they are 12 or 14 years old. So Locke conceived working schools where the children of poor working people above 3 years old would be required to go for forced labor above 3 years old. And Locke argued that, well, the mother, this will help the mother because she will be eased of a great part of her trouble in looking after and providing for her children. She'd be more at liberty to work if the children were required to go to this work camp or work, working school, so-called. So he goes on that way. Then you have the famous constitutions of the government of Carolina in 1669, earlier on, where Locke really gives it away and drafted a constitution to establish a hereditary nobility in the United States. That's really coherent with the idea of a republic. The lords proprietors who were granted this land in Carolina asked Locke to draft a so-called constitution, and Locke's constitution is full of phrases like the lords of the manor may do this and that, the signory and barony and manors and leetmen. He uses his leetmen as the same as serfdom, that the serfs are owned and by the lord of the manor and can be sold along with the land, and the children of serfs shall be serfs to all generations, and the lords will be a hereditary nobility, passing their titles to their firstborn sons, and of course also sanctioning black slavery. There was a dispute at the time whether blacks who became Christians could be enslaved, and Locke had no problem with that. Absolutely, there's no question about it. So that is John Locke, and the idea that somehow we continue to accept, and students going to school would continue to accept this, that is the problem, and it's not just an academic question. And, you know, everyone should see this, especially youth today, is that the extent this is accepted, then this is what leads to the idea that the United States is an imperialist power, and we see this kind of false or let's say, conflict in the world, where it actually we need the assistance of the rest of the world in order to restore the United States to its actual purpose.
Good, Phil. Now, thank you. And you're listening to The LaRouche Show, so you've devastated this myth that John Locke is in any way a founder. Let's have one or the other. David, maybe you want to say something on the other person who's written out of history, Gottfried Leibniz, is the influence.
Well, surely. John Locke, certainly a dirty view of mankind, and nothing good could come of that. Gottfried Leibniz, people can think about as the Lyndon LaRouche of the 17th and 18th centuries, early 18th centuries. He was born in 1646 and he died in 1716, and he's been for 300 years the cause of massive freakouts by this group in London they call themselves the Venetian Party, this Anglo-Dutch liberalism that says man is a beast, go run after greedy, you know, pursuit of money, get what you can. So Leibniz had a different idea, which this country was founded upon, and it's a point in history right now. People have to make a deliberate effort to recall what this country was founded on. It was something good. And LaRouche's emphasis on recalling that we're something different than the Anglo-Dutch imperialism is absolutely critical to us pulling ourselves out of this mess that our neoconservatives have gotten us into.
Well, let me ask Ed to say something about it way back, at maybe the earliest time, 16, early 1700s, about the transatlantic interconnections.
Let me identify one idea from Leibniz and then end with that, which is simply the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is Leibniz's concept. And Ben Franklin met with Leibniz's people. We'll talk about that later, about that. But the idea is dramatically different from everything Phil told you about Locke, which is that what is required for life is not running after property. What is required for life is that man have the liberty to invent, that he be different from animals and automatons, that the creator of the universe, the composer of the universe, made a happy universe. That's what happiness is, that what's necessary for life is freedom, that freedom is necessary. That's the concept of happiness. We'll talk more about that later.
So what about the Leibniz direct influence?
Well, it's interesting. Phil mentions Locke's involvement with the poor laws, and what do you do with the children of the poor? This is actually a very crucial point, and exemplifies the question of the general welfare, which is how do you treat kids? What do you do with kids? What do you do with poor kids, with working class kids, and so forth? This is a crucial issue around the time of Cotton Mather and Franklin's youth. I got into looking at this from Graham Lowry's book, How the Nation Was Won, in which he traces the Republican tradition in the founding of the United States and the American Revolution back to the Massachusetts Bay Colony and John Winthrop in 1630 up through Increase Mather and Cotton Mather, and in Cotton Mather as the mentor of Benjamin Franklin. And Franklin, of course, he's the personification, the embodiment of the concept of the general welfare. Now, one of the big issues was this question of children. And Mather wrote, I mean, one of the important books that he wrote was this thing called Bona Facius, or Facius, depending on how you pronounce your Latin, Essays on Doing Good, which Franklin identified as one of the key influences, one of the most important books influences on his life and his activity. This was in turn based on, in part, on Mather's correspondence with the people in Halle, Germany, a Leibnizian circle of people grouped around a fellow named Franke, August Hermann Franke, who ran, you can guess from my intro, an orphanage, right, for dealing with poor kids. And these were called the Halle institutions, or the Franken institutions, or the Halle Stiftungen in German. And this was actually, there was extensive correspondence between Franke and Cotton Mather, and also actually some people in England, because there was a Republican current in England at the time also. And this question of educating the children of the poor, what was a critical issue in this? You can contrast, if you take Locke's view, right, if you go back earlier into the early 1700s, this fellow Mandeville, Bernard Mandeville, is the progenitor of Locke, and as well as, of course, he's claimed as the intellectual godfather of von Hayek and von Mises and Friedman and all the free market.
Newt Gingrich, you mean?
Yeah,
everybody?
Exactly, that crowd, the conservative revolution crowd. Because Mandeville took the attitude, it sounds very similar to what Phil described about Locke, that it's a waste of time to educate the children of the poor, that they're not going to be fit for drudge work. You need a class of people who can do drudge work so that other people can live in luxury. I mean, that's just the way the world is, according to Mandeville and also according to John Locke. It's according to his constitution for the Carolinas. So how do you maintain a class of poor, ignorant people who will do drudge work and not object? You can't do this if you start educating them. So Mandeville had actually written an essay on charity schools, which is what these things were called, about how it's such a waste of time to educate poor children. Mather in Boston actually created charity schools, which were modeled on the Halle orphanage and the Halle institutions. And this Franklin was also very much involved in this, originally in Massachusetts and also in Philadelphia. So it's an embodiment of the general concept, and it shows very clearly the factional line. I mean, this Mandeville, you can trace it up to the present day, and as you said, Newt Gingrich, Mandeville, Locke, von Hayek, Milton Friedman, Newt Gingrich, up to the present day, versus the Commonwealth or the common welfare, the general common good, general welfare faction.
So it's each versus all in one view, or it's there is a common good and it can be deliberately promoted. Now, this fight of ideas in forming the United States and Benjamin Franklin's role and so forth, there was this period in Germany when the what became the United States were a bunch of colonies. You could speak about a German Renaissance. Some of us just know of things like J.S. Bach was active. So, but we often think of settlers to America as just the pilgrims. That's the usual cartoon version you get. Dave, maybe you would say something about this real input into the United States and back again.
Oh, sure. I mean, this is a case where Gottfried Leibniz's ideas could not be stamped out, even though he's the one who created the Hanover House, the King George I, King George II. His major student, Sophie, was supposed to become head of England, and she died, and George I, who was not a big Leibniz proponent, became head, and the Venetian party grabbed hold of him. But the Leibniz writings were seized by George I.
In Germany, or where?
In Hanover, mm-hmm. Where Hanover is part of England. It was jointly ruled. This Hanover House in northern Germany. So the Leibniz's papers were a major threat. They could not counter Leibniz. Leibniz, just last word on that, in 1711, 1712, 1713, the same time Ed's describing that Franke and Mather are in touch with each other, Leibniz is the major player in courts throughout Europe, like LaRouche on the Strategic Triangle. The Strategic Triangle then was Russia, Austria. Leibniz had gotten a major hold in Austria at the time, had connections into France, and his student Sophie was about to take over in England. This was the horror of the Venetian party. So Sophie died and George I came in, they simply seized all of Leibniz's documents upon his death in 1716. So in the 1730s and 40s, you have a very interesting situation where Benjamin Franklin comes in, is that the people who are proponents of Leibniz in his home city of Leipzig, a man named Abraham Kessner, a youth at the time, about 20 years old, who was puzzled that these great ideas of Leibniz and Kepler, actually, were being deliberately suppressed. So he had two students, an astronomer named Christlob Mylius, and his cousin came in, a young man named Gottfried Lessing. And these people in the 1740s in Germany took great offense to the attacks against Leibniz, and it just motivated them forward. It turns out that in the United States at the same time, Benjamin Franklin and a friend of his, Cadwallader Colden, were very excited about some of the possibilities of electrical experiments, and they saw this as a direct opposition to this inane theory that was being pushed about empty space from an Isaac Newton approach. So what's not well known is that Kessner got a hold of Cadwallader Colden's book against Newton's idea of empty space, for the idea of investigating physics with an ether and the characteristics of the ether, including the atmosphere, including electricity, and published that in German. And when Franklin's experiments were publicized in Germany and France and England in 1751 and 52, one of the big later supporters of the American Revolution, the man known as Duc de Noailles, excuse my French, Duc de Noailles, put on these experiments for the first time, and it got everybody excited, including Kessner and his student Mylius. The end of that part of the story is Kessner decided he had to send his student Mylius over to Philadelphia to meet with Benjamin Franklin and probably also with Cadwallader Colden. That part of the story ends because Milius, Christo Milius, at the young age of 31, died in London of natural causes, supposedly. That story has not been figured out yet.
So, in other words, the back and forth around the idea of there's a common good that can be promoted, and secondly, it should have advanced science, is what you're saying, conceptualizing electricity or the universe. You're describing a network. Let me ask Phil to say just say a couple of things now before we have a program announcement break. Phil, you're listening to the LaRouche Show, on the kind of view of what could be done in infrastructure building or in terms of applied science. You've done a lot of work on electricity and steam power. What was the picture?
Well, before we get into that, let me just mention that in terms of why we're discussing this and the passion for historical research, just to make a suggestion, maybe we can pick up the other question again. Here, Steve Douglas, who is the regional or a national committee member here in Philadelphia, asked a bunch of students a very good question one time. He asked them, what is the most important date of your life? I want you to think about, what is the most important date of your life? And I asked this question, I was out in Detroit last week, and people usually come up with something in their lifetimes, and one person even said the day of conception, not even birth. But they think of something within their lifetimes. And, of course, you put on the board, what about July 4th, 1776? Or what about another important date in history which shaped your life, which made your life possible, which you know, shaped who you are? Isn't that a most important date of your life as well? And then you ask the question, look at these historical figures, Abraham Lincoln and others, or Franklin, Lincoln who was assassinated. Was his sacrifice in vain? And you always conclude, we don't know yet, because it's up to us. The outcome of his life isn't determined, so we change the outcome of the past. So I think with that attitude, then there's a passion for finding the truth and establishing justice for these people. And I do want to address what you said. One thing I wanted to mention.
Oh, Phil, can I ask you to hold that thing?
Sure.
I'll make the program announcement so you can add all your comments here. I'll just get it out of the way, as we say. I say again, you're listening to the LaRouche Show, and it's weekly from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock on the Internet every Saturday. That's Eastern Time at 3 o'clock. And those of you listening on the website know the site, but those of you listening on shortwave or on the organizer's LaRouche conference call, you know it's on www.larouchepub.com. And that's spelled www.larouchepub.com. And I also want to emphasize, at any time, if you're in the United States, you can call in to the toll-free number to follow up, get more information, and get information out. That's 888, that's toll-free, 888-347-3258. I'll repeat, 888-347-3258. I also want to emphasize, I'm going to introduce the youth panel that's participating today, the youth leader panel. But those of you who are on the website and want to send in emails during the next half hour, if we can get them in, we will. Otherwise, we'll get back to you. And you know, you can see there on your screen, but you send emails at any time to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And otherwise, do call in to the toll-free number. I'll give it once again before we conclude. And now, before I return to Phil Valenti on this important, on these matters of history and current history, I want to say I do hope technically nothing's wrong. We should have on our line these three people: Bill Roberts in Detroit, John Craig in Los Angeles, and Elizabeth Nash in Houston, who are part of our North American LaRouche Youth Movement leaders. And I know they're scholars in terms of a lot of the American history we've just been talking about. Okay, Phil, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll hear from any one of the Bill, John, or Elizabeth people, or David and Ed here in the studio. Go ahead, Phil.
All right, good. Again, just from the standpoint of the textbook history, you have to question everything. For example, students, particularly who will take math classes or calculus, will hear the story about who invented the calculus. And they'll hear, well, there was a dispute between Leibniz and Newton. And actually, Newton discovered it, and Leibniz maybe discovered it independently, and maybe they were equal discoverers, but Leibniz had claimed he discovered it first, and there's an implication that Leibniz stole it from Newton. And you hear these things. So what is it all about? Is it an academic dispute in the area of mathematics and something you can just brush aside, or what's really going on? So you find out that this dispute occurred in about 1710, 1711, 1712, and then you find out that Leibniz was the teacher or the mentor, philosophical mentor, of the woman, as David mentioned, the Electress Sophie in Hanover, who was going to become Queen of England any day on the death of Queen Anne. So Leibniz would be in a position of quite influential position in England. So wouldn't you think that there'd be people in England who would be upset about this and terrified about it, who would do everything they could to destroy Leibniz, destroy his reputation, guarantee he could never come to England, that they would start a equivalent of a anti-communist witch hunt against this German foreigner who stole the achievements of our great English hero, Isaac Newton. And that's exactly what it was. It was a pure political frame-up. And you look into the history, you find that the Royal Society of England put people up to make these accusations. They officially condemned Leibniz, and of course the condemnation was written by Newton himself.
Anonymous
judge,
right?
jury, and executioner. So purely a political frame-up. And so one of the things that jumps out at you, and this is another issue of history that was really suppressed, is, well, what do the Americans think of this? And here in Philadelphia, back in the 70s, we discovered, some of us here in the Pennsylvania Historical Society, that there's a book there sitting on the shelves that was lost for 250 years. It was discovered in early 1970s, written by James Logan, who was Secretary of William Penn, and another mentor of Benjamin Franklin when he came to Philadelphia. And it was a book in longhand. It's on the shelf in the Historical Society. And what is it about? It is an attack on Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and Isaac Newton. It's a refutation of the entire heroes of British so-called liberal philosophy, which he wrote, never was published to this day, but he circulated among Franklin and others of the young people around Franklin to educate them against the influences of British liberal philosophy. And actually, and this is a whole other question on the question of science, but there's parts of this book which critique Newton and suggest that a greater significance for electricity than just static electricity, which I'm quite sure was the inspiration for Franklin's kite experiment later on, to show that electricity somehow permeated the universe and permeated the space above the atmosphere, and somehow permeated space. And this is something that Franklin wanted to demonstrate, that hypothesis. So the real scientific discovery always comes from these hypotheses and metaphysical hypotheses, not trial and error, including things like the steam engine and other things we could talk about.
Great. Thanks a lot, Phil. I'm going to just, again, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. I'm going to just turn to the youth panel and ask one of our participants to pipe up, and we'll see where it goes. Go right ahead, one of you.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Would you speak up a little, or maybe the engineers will turn you up. Go right ahead. Is this Bill or John?
This is John from Los Angeles.
Go right ahead, John.
Yeah, I've read some of your articles, especially David's new article in the Fidelio, which is really excellent, because I've had a lot of research I've been doing, trying to figure out how the connection between Benjamin Franklin and a lot of his other founding fathers, you know, what they were actually reading by these guys, and I could kind of see their philosophy. Essentially, one question I kind of have, though, is just, you know, a lot of these other people around the constitutional period, you know, this fight, you know, with, you know, Madison and Hamilton and Jefferson and whatnot. And I was kind of wondering, you know, I mean, it seems like some of these people have a confused conception of this. And I don't know how, if anyone, I don't, any, this question's for anyone of the, you know, David Red or Phil. But I was just wondering if anyone knew how, you know, could tell me a little bit about that fight, you know, amongst the founding fathers.
I'm going to defer to Ed for most of that, but the one comment, I think it's very important. I mean, it's not just a matter of attacking John Locke, he's the bad guy. The reason John Locke was successful in his argument on his essays on human understanding was that most people, when they're thoughtless, have the opinion that your senses, what you see, what you smell, what you taste, you know, what you, your five senses is reality. And that the Venetian party can always manipulate a population then and today around that. So what Franklin, there was a 10-day period, I don't know about one day, but there was a 10-day period in Franklin's life which was absolutely critical when he went and visited with Kestner and a student of Kestner's named Rossby. And these people had, after 50 years of the suppression of Leibniz's manuscripts, had very courageously published Leibniz's full treatment of Locke. Locke certainly was read by the American colonists. He was promulgated as somebody that says, if you want freedom, you know, fight for your personal property. And there's many, many people who would repeat those things either in thoughtless moments or because they really believed it. But Franklin actually spent 10 days working through the details systematically, like LaRouche has you working through Gauss. There's a reason for this, you know, because you've got to convince yourself, you've got to work through for yourself what your soul actually looks like if you're going to be successful, make a revolution like Franklin did. But Ed, you want to handle some of the details on?
Well, I would say this, that it's difficult if you try and start from the standpoint of the Constitution or the Constitutional Convention to really make sense out of what happened there. And this is why, again, Graham Lowry's book is so important, because the key person in all of this is Benjamin Franklin, right? And even if you read the debates of the Constitutional Convention, you'll see a lot of Leibnizian ideas there, which are not discussed in those terms, and you don't even know if the people were conscious of that's what they were citing, you know, or if they had come to them indirectly through, you know, other influences. But as I showed in my article on the general welfare a couple of years ago, on the conception of the general welfare, to understand the Constitution, you have to look at the Articles of Confederation, which, of course, has nothing to do with the Confederacy. And it was Franklin who drafted those in 1775. And in there you have, put there by Franklin, the conception of the general welfare. It was put then in terms of our mutual and general welfare. And there's a direct continuity to what you end up with in the Constitutional Convention from what Franklin personally drafted. So, I mean, I make that point to say, if you start and say, well, it was Madison who drafted the Constitution, and how did this stuff get in there? You have to look at the environment in which that took place. And Jefferson, Madison, these guys, they're not one or the other. Jefferson actually improved over time. Madison, you know, they could be pulled along by stronger figures, such as either Franklin or Hamilton. And in that period, it was Hamilton who had the clearest conception of the Leibnizian commitment in terms of a government. You know, what does it take to have a government that promotes the general welfare? It's not just that you have, you know, much as I like to read about orphanages and charity, it's not simply orphanages and charity and being nice to one another. You must have a scientific orientation. Franklin, you know, embodied this as Leibniz did earlier. How do you promote and develop science and technology for the purpose of promoting the general welfare? You can't have the general welfare unless you have that. If the driving influence is a private, you know, bank like the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England, if that's what drives your society, you cannot promote the general welfare. And Hamilton in that period embodies that with his reports on manufacturing, on credit, on the National Bank, and so forth.
Thanks. That's a tremendous, it pulls a lot of things together. John, unless you have something else, could I ask Bill or Elizabeth, do you want to put in some thoughts right here, either a comment or a question?
Yeah, actually, I have a question.
Elizabeth Nash from Houston. Yeah. Go ahead.
My question is, a lot of these individuals who were extremely influential in helping us to establish this republic. I mean, I've never heard of a lot of these people: Franca, Colden, Duc de Noailles, Milius, others, Munchausen. I mean, how do you actually go about figuring out and piecing together in a historical context that we're in today? I mean, these kinds of people. I mean, how did you run? I mean, I'm sure that it must have been years and years and years of work. But in addition to that, I mean, how did you actually go about figuring out how they were influential in shaping what Franklin was able to do here in the United States.
I could say something on that.
Yeah, Phil's the pioneer on this.
Well, just it reminds me of Schiller's poem about Columbus. And you know, Lynn had said all along, based on his understanding of epistemology, there's no way that Locke, despite all the textbooks, despite all the authorities, could have been the influence on the American Revolution that is claimed, just from the standpoint of knowing the epistemology. Mm-hmm. There's no way this idea of man as a beast and based on their senses and the Aristotelian philosophy that you could have established something like the American Republic, the Constitution, with all its flaws. He was convinced it's impossible. You look for it and you'll find it. So this is what motivated many of us, is we're passionately committed to finding that. It's like the poem about Columbus, right? Even if there were no North American continent, it would rise from the seas to meet him because of his genius. I mean, that this had to be. So I think that's part of it. You take some of the, because Lynn is throwing out all these hints, and I mean, Joan of Arc, all these things. There's so much that we don't know. Like the question John asked about the other founders, there's so much we don't know. I mean, I tend to think that there was a degeneration, that the generation after Franklin was not as sophisticated on these things as he was. So he was instrumental in trying to educate a youth movement of that day. Think about Hamilton being 19 years old and is the adjutant for George Washington and Lafayette, and then let alone John Quincy Adams.
And I think Franklin took young Robert Fulton under his arm, under his wing. What about the other two guys? Do you have any response to Elizabeth?
Well, sure. I think Phil's earlier comments, both comments are appropriate. You have to have a passion for the truth. If you see a paradox, if you believe that human beings are good and you see your country doing something evil, it's your responsibility to figure it out. You can't be quietistic. So it's a paradox. It's a scientific problem. So you're going to have a passion to only accept an explanation of what's going on that helps you do your mission in the world. If you hear an explanation which is stupid, even if it's 99% or 110% of what you hear, it's stupid. So, you know, when you LaRouche gives you a little bit of a insight in how he's reacting to the present ugliness. When you've proven to yourself certain basic things about who you are, that you're not just five senses with a given amount of time to live and then, you know, seek as much pleasure as you can. When you solve that problem, you can do detective work and sniff out all sorts of things. The enemy has a hard time hiding certain basic matters. It's in the Constitution. It says pursuit of happiness. The last thing on that one, you know, the fellow that Phil was mentioning, the quote that I had used that was in the textbooks in the 1950s, was from a professor at Harvard named Carl Friedrichs. This was the associate of William Yandel Elliott. These two guys created the generation of fascists that we have today, Brzezinski, Kissinger, Huntington. You're watching their work. He is the one who said, oh, pursuit of happiness, that's no different than life, liberty, and property, or life, liberty, and estates. It's just a stylistic change, I guess. When you see a big fat lie like that, you know you're onto something. You know you've got the tip of the iceberg, and you'll have some passion. You'll track that thing through.
I'm sorry, has anyone got anything to say?
Yes, is this Bill?
No, this is John.
John, go ahead, and then I'll turn to Bill in a minute. Please, John Craig, Los Angeles, go right ahead. This is the LaRouche Show.
Yeah, I wanted to, this question is for, for Phil Valenti. I actually, I haven't quite finished your article on Newton, the anti-Newtonian, roots of the revolution, but I was kind of wondering if you could talk a little bit about how Benjamin Franklin's lightning experiment was explicitly against Newton. And
well, this is
always the hardest battle I have, you know, with people. You know, is always about Newton. It always helps. It works really good bringing up Leibniz and talking about that. I mean, and really, you know, showing this other side. But that's the fight, you know.
Yeah. Well, this is my own hypothesis here it comes from this book by James Logan that I was telling you about, which, again, it's a fascinating thing. Here's this book in longhand, never published, on the shelves of the Historical Society, which is an attack on Hobbes, Locke, and Newton.
About 1700 or when, Phil?
1720s.
Okay.
The 1730s, when Franklin was, you know, in his 20s, probably. His wife was born 1706, so he was early 20s. So in this book, there's a whole section about the question of the atoms in the void. This was the Newtonian fad, that the world is made up of fundamental particles that can only move if there's a vacuum of free of matter around them. This is the idea that Newton was promoting. And of course, this is where you get the idea of gravitation is between two bodies, and you have this inverse square law, which was derived from Kepler. But once you get three bodies, it doesn't work anymore. It's fairly useless. But this is what Logan was concerned to refute. And what he does, he makes a suggestion in this footnote that what about electricity? We can't see what's between bodies, but perhaps it's much more substantial than things we can see. And so he makes a suggestion that, that maybe this electric fluid, whatever it is, might qualify as something that's out there in the universe generally that fills space somehow. So my hypothesis is that this is what Franklin, of course, also objected to this idea of fundamental particles. You see that in his letters all the time when he talks about light and that it can't, light can't be a particle. And he says, I'm much in the dark about light. He has all these puns that he makes. So what he did, so in that context, flying the kite to demonstrate the identity of lightning with sparks of static electricity. Electricity was seemingly a small thing that you rub fur on amber and you get sparks and you can collect it in a Leyden jar. But is it something much more to it? Is it identical with lightning, which means it somehow permeates space? This is what I think he was doing. It was attempting to confirm a hypothesis, which was a refutation of Newton of the day, which was suggested by Logan.
Thanks.
Thank you. And I know I'm turning to Bill. By the way, there's a big conference taking place in Detroit this weekend. Jeff and Michelle Steinberg, you know from the LaRouche Show, they're both out there in Detroit. Bill Roberts in Detroit, are you still on, and do you want to put a point right now?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go right ahead, Bill.
Okay. I've been looking at Franklin and looking at a couple of different biographies, namely the Carl Van Doren biography. And I'm just thinking of this question of the difference, the complete fundamental difference between Franklin's conception of wealth and the conception of, you know, the British oligarchy, their conception of wealth. Franklin was promoting scientific discovery. He was promoting learning through the American Philosophical Society, and he wanted to actually use discoveries and use a collaboration around these ideas to expand the population of the colonies in North America. Now, it seems as though the way Franklin is often portrayed is that there was just a fight. Okay, the American Revolution was a fight over taxes. It actually seems as though Van Doren says that Franklin's intention was actually to shift the seat of power and actually eventually have a seat of power in North America for the British Empire, as ridiculous as that seems. But to continue in the same vein of empire but he just had a different conception. There are obviously huge paradoxes with this. I'm just wondering, you know, what else was actually going on in the British Empire at the time of the American Revolution? What was going on in India? And also, in this period between 1750 and leading up to the outbreak of the American Revolution, Franklin was meeting with these different oligarchs and such, and he met with Adam Smith. And there seems to be no distinction made between Franklin's correspondence with Republican networks and his brief run-ins with these networks of the oligarchy. So I guess I'd just like someone to expound upon that. And also, maybe if someone knows, you know, what was Van Doren up to? I mean, it seems as though either he had no conception of this this more philosophical battle, or he just chooses to ignore it.
Thank you. Phil, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I mean, on the face of it, it sounds like he's arguing that Franklin was a forerunner of Paul Wolfowitz.
Right.
And somehow that we need to have a world empire, and the center of it's going to shift to America, which is exactly what they're trying to do with Iraq. This is a new Anglo-American empire, and the British are, let's say, the allies of the United States, or the second banana to the United States, or the shift, the center of the empire chain. So it sounds like he's writing from the standpoint of justifying the kind of policy you see right now. And also on the question of Franklin's intention, look, later on, Robert Fulton, who was a protege of Franklin in these circles, he was clearly intending, and Matthew Carey and others, to not just have American independence. They intended to overthrow the British monarchy. They intended to overthrow the government of Britain. In fact, Fulton was designing submarines and torpedoes, proposing that they could be used to destroy the entire British fleet, cause a panic in England, lead to an uprising in Ireland, which would lead to an overthrow of the monarchy and overturning of the British Empire. That was their goal.
Right. Dave, do you have a response?
Well, sure. I mean, on these authors, these academics, Phil put it correctly, but more generally, it takes an effort of will and honesty to actually account for singular individuals in history. It takes, whether it's Joan of Arc or Socrates or Franklin, any biography you read of these people will almost automatically be incompetent unless the person approaching that subject actually wants to do something competent and scientific. So don't be too surprised at that. What's going on in Britain at the time, they were making the choice that the United States has, whether to become an empire or not. They had England wasn't always bad. They had, in the period Phil described, around 1688-89, in the founding of the bank in 1694, they had this Venetian party, moving in on them, and there was a brawl going on in the English-speaking world. By 1763, the end of the French and Indian War, or the Seven Years' War, the British Parliament and the financial forces there wanted to lock in the United States, the colonies, along with India, into just a tax farming scheme, into just, we're going to loot you. This had happened before in history. Franklin has a very direct quote about all this in 1766. He wins the fight in England. He's in London, and he testifies to the Parliament, and he tells them it's stupid for them to tax farm the United States, that it's a bad way to run the English world. And he's okay if England takes the right choice on policy questions to stay within England at that time. That doesn't make him an imperialist. He wins the fight, and then he goes to Germany to meet with the Leibnizians there. When he comes back, he sees that the government in Britain has been changed by the fall of 1766. The Pitt government has taken over, and he proposes to them that we develop the internal parts of the United States. It's called the Illinois Company. And the objection is made to him that the Illinois Company doesn't help them tax farm the colonies. It would establish a whole different principle inside the United States, because that's like going inside and actually developing the area to have more people be happy. And we're not going to do that. We're just going to have a few colonies near the coast that we can easily take the raw materials from them. So this was people who do honest scholarship, they can go look and see these issues. It's not, you just don't get frustrated by the voluminous amount of nonsense that's out there. It's like listening to every opinion when you go out and organize, listening to everybody's opinion on the street and not knowing it's all coming from some idiotic thing from the media, 3 minutes before.
Can I just say one thing? When you really have to approach any of these things, it's as a detective, it's detective work. Any biography, anything of the sort you read, we have to look at it. There may be one or two items in there of use, and most of it is not. Franklin was a conspirator. He had to do much of his work in secret. He had to hide much of what he was doing. And that was true. I mean, as David goes back and talked about the suppression of Leibniz's work, the Leibniz networks had to operate very much in secret. And that's one of the problems in trying to, determine how they did what they did. How did they accomplish the American Revolution? And the second problem is, apart from the fact that they had to operate in secret, so much of this has been suppressed in the writing of history. I mean, the role of the Germans and the Leibniz networks in the American Revolution are scarcely there in any history books.
Thanks. By the way, I'll just break in here to this discussion. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, because we've had an email asking for a quick update on how it looks out in Detroit at the conference. Bill, do you want to tell us? It's a big North American conference here just at the time we're having one in Germany, too. What's the picture out there?
Yeah, well, the place is packed. We have a large contingent of students, and it's it's looking pretty good. It's going to be pretty much an all-day event. So this could really be a launching point for the youth movement even. So it looks good.
So you're filling in the continent of North America as was planned centuries ago, Bill, right?
Yes.
Very good, and I'm glad to get that report. We have a very few minutes. I want to throw in one thing on history. You should know that what's in preparation is a current history of the pedigree of these war hawks that have been forcing the U.S. into this non-American imperial mode. And it's going to be a pamphlet. It's going to be called The Children of Satan. That will have a very big impact in Washington and elsewhere. As I say, this is the LaRouche Show, and our phone number at any time to follow up on getting material, the books or the magazines, and especially the multi-million run material we're getting out is 888-347-3258, especially those listening on shortwave. And in a few minutes, you'll continue on the conference call with Harley Schlanger and the guests that you've been hearing and the youth as well. And remember, Harley, in this issue of the Schiller Institute's latest magazine called Fidelio, is discussing pop culture, how the Wall Street mob gave us what we think is popular. I'm just throwing that in along with the history of the past. But back to the youth, Elizabeth, John, and Bill, do you want to throw in anything here before we close?
Yeah, well, I want to ask if there is I can't remember who said, but it was said that there was a lot not known in the time of the founding fathers, and I was just wondering if what would be a good place to look, you know, where you three have done such a lot of work on this. I was wondering if you had any idea what would be what's kind of the place that hasn't been, you know, reached in all this.
Any one of you jump right in.
Ed, why don't you take that one?
I think Phil was talking about Madison and everyone else, too, some of the people that are...
I mean, it's easier to say what we do know than what we don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
And if we could answer that question, we'd be there.
And it's not on the Internet.
Yeah, okay. I want to study... I'm trying to study Madison and a lot of this battle in that time, and I was just... Maybe you guys haven't had a chance to look
at it. Just arm yourself with the Leibniz-Clark letters. Do what LaRouche did when he was 14.
Sure.
You know, arm yourself with that, and anything else you go looking at in that period that you think you want to personally account for, it won't destroy you. You'll be armed sufficiently.
It's also very important to read primary sources and to read what people themselves wrote as opposed to someone else said about them, because you always find things that are, you know, you're very pleasantly surprised to find out what people actually said, because the axioms in that period were so different than what we are today.
Did Madison say anything about the slavery debate at the Constitutional Convention? He wrote notes on the debate at the conventions.
A lot, actually.
I've never read it, but that would be good, John.
Great, terrific, and I want to thank all of you. Those of you talking on the panel can stay on for the LaRouche call. This has been the LaRouche Show. It's on every week from 3 to 4 and on Internet and on shortwave. Thank you all for listening. We'll be on next Saturday, every Saturday. It's on at 3 o'clock.